I think the you know, the fork in the road, you know, when we come to compassion, you know, I think about two things. I think about responsibility and I think about trust. And responsibility first is responsibility to yourself. And kind of the, what we were just talking about is really understanding your own authenticity and learning how to, you know, become whole and you know, reconcile those self-limiting beliefs and the false stories that we built our persona on, and then having the courage, you know, to step forward as this authentic self, you know, to understand what your purpose is. And so I don't think that we can really help anyone else heal until we've healed ourselves.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. And today we are in search of the new compassionate male. I'm the producer and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. How you doing? Today, we have Jeff Bullion with us. And say hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Right on cue. I wanted to know.
This is the way I like to start a podcast.
That's how I would have done it. I was trying to remember when it was you and I met.
We met in probably like circa 2016, 2017 at Unity Church in Austin. And when I joined the Men's Fellowship.
Okay. And you heard about us, I guess, one Sunday or something.
Yeah, well, it's a long belabored story, but the synopsis.
We want that. We want to know how, what is important to us to know how we as men come to the place where we say we need to continue growing. We need to be part of this process of healing and growing as men. So your story is very important to us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I just wanted to say, too, that I'm excited to be on the show with you guys and have the opportunity to talk about this. It's an area that's, you know, close to my heart, and I'm pretty, you know, passionate about it. And we can get into that through today's conversation. But, you know, back to how Clay and I met, I was going through a point in my life where I had a lot of turbulence. I was going through a divorce from a 23-year marriage, and I was really looking to make significant changes in my life. I wasn't happy, you know, and some of the things that I realized that were preventing my happiness were myself. You know, I just didn't allow myself. I just shackled myself with so many of these self-limiting beliefs that I had about, you know, the way the world worked and what my role was in that world. And it really pushed me into making some, you know, serious changes. I think the first realization that I made was that, you know, if I really want to make a change, I have to change my environment. I can't continue to do the same things that I do day in and day out and expect to have some kind of change in my life. And so, you know, one of the first big leaps that I took was, you know, going to Unity Church. And, you know, I got into Unity Church, and it was a really great experience having grown up, you know, in the Roman Catholic Church, you know, where everything was different, right? The idea of a sin was not a penalty, right? It was part of human nature. And so those kind of things started resonating with me. And then I think shortly thereafter, I joined the Men's Fellowship Network, which is something that, you know, Clay hosted back in that day. And I remember sitting in that circle for the first time and listening to, you know, like 20 other guys be just open and vulnerable and talking about stuff. And I don't think I said anything for at least maybe the first three or four meetings anyways, you know, before I got in there. But I can tell you the dialogue that was going on in my head was like, what did you just get yourself into, Jeff? You know, eventually you're going to have to open your mouth and say something, you know? So, I remember after one of the first times that I spoke, I was really like, just kind of, I was flushed and I was overwhelmed. And I remember saying something to one of the other guys there, and he said, "Oh, good, it's working." It's like, that's what vulnerability feels like, you know. It's that humiliation, it's that pain.
Oh.
All this stuff that you've been trying to avoid, it's right here. And so week after week I attended and I became more participatory and it became very cathartic. It was kind of a fueling stop for me throughout the week. And then to hear other guys' stories and hear how much their stories were like my stories was really what resonated. And I realized it wasn't just me. You know, these guys were having the same experiences. And this guy was a cowboy from over here. And this guy was a TV producer. And this guy was a musician. And, you know, and so we all came from these different walks of life, but we all shared these common experiences.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, part of the journey. And along the way, I did some other things. I became a spiritual life coach. So
that's
I got
right.
certified, and I do that today. I still work in that field. I do it on the side. I still have a professional sales job, but I work with people on the side and I do that. So, and I do a bit of writing. So when Clay asked me about this, actually, kind of a segue, one of the papers that I'm working on right now is, it's called Compassionate Boundaries.
Mm.
And
oh.
the reason why I started writing about the idea of compassionate boundaries is, you know, I'm looking at the world today and it feels so polarized. And, you know, everybody is on one side or the other and everybody, you know, has such a need to be right. And nobody really wants to invest a whole lot of time trying to understand the other side. And so I thought about this and, you know, one of the things that I've studied a bit is that, you know, Joseph Campbell's kind of his tension of opposites.
Yes.
And so I think we all live in that realm of this tension of opposites. And the compassionate part, you know, compassion is the reconciliatory part. You know, it reconciles the tension of opposites. It gives us the opportunity to be open enough to understand. And so, but the boundaries are kind of there as well to protect you from getting hurt because you can't engage with everybody the same way. You're going to find that not everybody's open to discourse. And so you then just become this guy who's banging on his soapbox and you're just the same as everybody else. You're fighting about what you believe is right. And so kind of that's what got me excited about, you know, being here today and, you know, getting in that environment.
You know, you were talking about the first few times that you were in the circle and not speaking. That is so common. And it's not uncommon for someone to be there 2 or 3 months and not say anything. In the very beginning, I thought, okay, everybody's got to speak. I got to watch so everybody speaks. And then finally I thought, well, wait a second. Who the heck do I think I am that I'm going to interrupt the processing that that person is doing? When it's time to speak, they'll speak and let it be. And that has seemed to really work. For me, it was the opportunity to spill out, to speak what was on my heart without fear of being judged or somebody trying to fix me or something like that. And that environment, that's what I needed.
Jeff, when you were looking at your early years and the year and the models of men that you were looking at, I'm the elder in this group at 72, Clay's in his mid 60s. You're in what era?
50s.
You're in your 50s. So we each had different generations as we have as models. But the models that you looked at is what was a man, what men were, what you were judging yourself against. Was that a major part of your consciousness growing as you were growing up?
I wouldn't say consciousness, but certainly an unconscious influence. You know, I think one of the keys and the first kind of aha awareness moments that I had from that perspective was, you know, I joined the Army when I was 17 years old and I was strongly influenced by, you know, the Rambo movies and the Delta Force movies that Chuck Norris was doing in those days. And so that was the macho, you know, kind of guy that grinded out the hero, the warrior, you know, kind of, archetype, you know, that I kind of followed and modeled, I think, more than anything. My father was a model that was a very, he was a dichotomy, you know, he was this wild, effusive guy, but he was also this extremely talented guy. He was a very restorative guy. He could fix anything. I used to always quote that, you know, Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He's like, my dad's got an awesome set of tools. He can fix anything, you know? So it was like, you know, that was how we grew up. And so one of the things I think when I started going through my own self-limiting beliefs is I would say I'm a jack of all trades and a master of none, because that's how I grew up. My dad had taught me how to do all these little tiny things, but I never felt like I was a specialist at anything, you know? Mm-hmm.
That is so powerful. The stories that we tell ourselves, and when do we go back and go, wait a minute, I keep telling myself that story, but that story is no longer true. Clay, you and I have talked about that how often, and look at you, how you're evolving in the story. Clay is an astonishing, you're an astonishing artist. And this artistic aspect of you that I get a chance to play with, that I get a chance to do, was not part of the story, the story that you told yourself.
No. I told myself down deep, yeah, I'm an artist, but put that to the side because you can't make any money doing that. So, you know, push that to the side. We got to go, you know. Y'all went into the Army. I went into the Marine Corps because I liked the uniform better. That happens to be a true story too, for another time.
Right.
But yeah, it was like I got to climb the ladder because that's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're trained to do, you know. And but in my heart of hearts, it was the artistic side, and you know, it's going to come out one way or the other. And luckily it didn't cost me my life in doing it. And as soon as I owned it and said, no, this is who I am, this is what I have to bring to the world, let's step into it. It made all the difference in the world.
One of the things that we're doing, Jeff, is that we're really trying to understand and to see how people define the word compassion as an active noun, not as a passive sitting back, but that it is something to where we engage in our lives in this. And you're dealing with compassionate boundaries in this, so we need your perspective on this and dig a little into compassionate boundaries so that we can learn more.
Yeah, I think the you know, the fork in the road, you know, when we come to compassion, you know, I think about two things. I think about responsibility and I think about trust. And responsibility first is responsibility to yourself. And kind of what we were just talking about is really understanding your own authenticity and learning how to, you know, become whole and, you know, reconcile those self-limiting beliefs and the false stories that we build our persona on. And then having the courage, you know, to step forward as this authentic self, you know, to understand what your purpose is. And so I don't think that we can really help anyone else heal until we've healed ourselves. And so, you know, that's the first part of the responsibility. The second part of the responsibility is to also understand where other people are. You have to be able to meet them, you know, where they are. And, you know, one of the things that I learned through coaching is, you know, instead of approaching with empathy or sympathy, which I used to think were all good things, those two things are loaded with a lot of judgment. But the thing that I learned that's not loaded with judgment is curiosity. Mm. And so the second that you start having that conversation with someone and you show a genuine interest in their perspective and where they came from, maybe why they feel the way that they do about something, you open the door to trust, right? You start building that trust foundation where you can then have a conversation and somebody will talk to you. It's non-judgmental. And so the responsibility leads you to the trust, right? And then that brings the compassion, right? That is the act of compassion in my eyes.
Boy, it's the art of conversation. You know, all I want to be is heard. You know, how many times have you said that to yourself? I just want to be heard. And for someone to take interest like what you're talking about, and oh, he heard me.
Right.
Oh, he didn't judge me. Well, now my heart's open.
Right.
And
I think we can all witness that, right? We've all had that opportunity, you know, where someone has shown you grace or compassion. Maybe it was a terrible time in your life, or maybe someone just stepped out and saw it, you know, and asked you about something and just hit you blindsided, you know, where you're like, wow, how did this person see this, right? I can't even see it in myself, but somebody else is able to see it in me. And then, you know, and maybe it doesn't take effect immediately, but it's certainly a seed that gets planted that gives you thought, and it provokes more thought, you know, until you're ready to address it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you know, grace, that was I hate to say it, but I have to say it, that it hasn't been until the last few years that I've begun to comprehend what that is.
Say more about it, Clay.
You know, some things you get taught with right and wrong and right and wrong, and you know, but at some point you say, look, there's grace in the situation, you know, move on. It's okay. And once I began to do that for myself, allow myself grace, then my hard edges kind of softened up. And I began to show up a little bit differently.
I have, you know, Jeff, can you talk a little bit about the difference between spirituality and religiosity, and the two ways that is interpreted in our minds and in the world?
Well, I'm no psychologist, but I do. Well, have
all right, but you play one on TV.
But I certainly, you know, having been on both sides of it, I think that, you know, both serve a purpose, right? They both serve a greater purpose, and that is to, you know, help us manage our humanness. You know, I like to say I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. And that applies, you know, whether you say I'm a religious person having a human experience, right? You are dedicated to something bigger than you, I think, is what the two things share. You know, now whether you're committed to a God out there in the religious sense, and most literally, I think where they divide is with spirituality. I think that a lot of us believe that God is within, right? And that's, you know, our spirit, our soul. And that's the connection that we have to God. And I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, religion has, is that they separate that. You know, many of the religions, you know, separate that, and God is out there. And I remember the first time that I even thought of the concept. I always remember, like, growing up in the Catholic Church, knowing about souls and having souls. But, you know, I knew that my soul was either going to go to hell or go to heaven, right? And so then when I got this idea of spirituality, that, you know, God is within me. Right. That's what I can bring forth to the world. I can bring my God nature forward every day. That's my spirituality. I can help other people. It really dawned on me that I was connected to everything and not just this one thing. And it really changed my perspective. And so I don't know if that explains it well enough. I mean, that's my perspective.
I used to think that, you know, religion and mythology were two totally different things. And somewhere along the line, someone started referring to religion as religious tradition.
Right.
And that kind of knocked the hard edge off of it. And I began to recognize that, you know, this is the wisdom being brought forward. You know, some of it on a religious side, from the standpoint of a way-shower, and following and having that structure, mythology, bringing the wisdom forward as well. And so the lines were really blurred for me. But there, how do we move ourselves, how do we move our culture or society forward? It's through the wisdom from the ages. And some of that you find in a religious structure. Similar messages are found through mythology.
I have never found that I've ever had a great insight that moved me that I have not gone, oh, I knew that. It was always a reminding rather than a learning of anything that mm-hmm. is profound, that has really moved me, has always been, of course, I knew that.
We've got the answer. That comes up sometimes when I'm journaling. I'll be writing with my dominant hand, and then I get to this place where I say, well, God, why is it this way? And I shift hands. And with my non-dominant hand, I start to write. And more times than not, it's, well, Clay, you know the answer to this question, don't you? Yeah, I do.
Jeff, where is your... where in your process, when we think of ourselves, because what we're the path that we're on in search of the new compassionate male is to see what are we going to look for in the 21st century and beyond for how both men and women can show up with the divine masculine, which we're looking at as the compassionate male part of it that is in both of us, just like we know and as we've done in unity and so many of the metaphysical end of Christianity, we understand the divine feminine. We have that strong connection to it. It appears to us in our search of what we're looking for is to see what would this archetype be of the divine masculine? How does it show up? And what Clay has so beautifully expressed, it shows up in through compassion and how that is an active noun. Yeah. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I wholly agree with that. And I think, you know, it goes back to reconciliation. I think the challenge that, you know, the work that we have to do as men, and a lot of men need to do, is to, you know, reconcile that divine feminine. You know, again, so if you grew up in an atmosphere, you know, where you had the archetype was to act this way, behave this way, or as Dana said in one of your previous podcasts, the mythology of, you know, what you believe your reality is. You know, we have to reconcile that somewhere. I grew up, you know, as a child, in a very, non-diverse environment, you know, and so, homophobia, for instance, was very normal. Misogyny was very normal. You know, we heard people telling jokes, belittling women, you know, doing a lot of these things. And so I grew up, and one of the things I realized was how much I objectified women. You know, I couldn't look at a woman without, you know, grading her in some way on her looks. And so I think the process, you know, for men is to first understand that, you know, and then you have to have a willingness to want to change, right? Understand that that's not okay. You know, that if you want to have a different world, if you want to live in a different world where your interaction with women is not about sexuality, you have to change your own beliefs, right? And so that is a challenge. And I almost think that it might be hardwired in DNA in us, because I still can't not do it. You know, I see an attractive woman, and sure, that thought goes through, but it doesn't give me the license to act on it, right?
I love how you said that, because what I have learned, one of the things I've learned, and I'd love to get y'all's experience on this, is that I am not responsible for the thought that comes into my head. I'm only responsible for those that I entertain. come and sit down, and if it comes through, because the weirdest stuff will go through my head. It's extraordinary what will go through my mind.
Nah, that never happens to me. Does it to you, Jeff?
No, never.
But if I will ruminate on it, or if I will judge myself for having the thought.
Mm-hmm.
But if I just go, nothing to see here, move it along, just let that be, then there isn't any stickiness to it. Then I can get back to what I'm here to do.
Yeah. Let me share a life hack with you. So one of the things that I like to do is when I find myself in wrong judgment is, and again, I use my divine nature in this way. If I see something that I'm in judgment of, I say, I am that, because I know that I am literally that. And so if I can then remove that separation by being that person, that thing that I'm judging, then it takes that all away, right? And I can either move to empathy or compassion or whatever it is that I want to be in. And I do find myself in judgment. I think we all do. So until we start making the course corrections, and you do it consciously and intentionally, it doesn't change. And so that's worked for me. I mean, I do it less and less now because of that.
I admire that.
What a beautiful.
Yeah, I'm interested in your coaching. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I went into, you want to talk about, being guided, mm-hmm. I was following Tony Robbins for several years. I really knew that I wanted to get into coaching. I had this realization that I really enjoyed, coaching in different ways. I did a lot of youth coaching, and I did one of those things. It was like, think about a time when, time disappeared and you were really immersed in what you're doing, really love what you're doing. And, it was when I was coaching. And so I kind of peeled that onion back a little bit more, and I realized it wasn't just the athletic part, but it was the fact that I was helping people and I was teaching, and that's what I think I am at the end of the day, is I'm a teacher. And so I started looking for life coaching programs, and I was going down the Robbins Madonna's path, and I decided to just do a search one day. And I said, spiritual coaching, and one website comes up. And I'm like, wow, what are the chances of that? And so I went on to the ICF, which is the Coaching Federation, International Coaching Federation. And I did a search in there for spiritual coaching. Same one comes up. So I said, okay. So I sent an email off and I said, hey, this is what I'm into. I'm looking at Tony Robbins. I'm into, Wayne Dyer, and telling her all the things that I'm like really into. And about 3 hours later, I get a phone call, and Jane Gardner, who's up in Dallas, Texas, calls me and starts telling me about her program. And it was a spiritual life coaching program. And she said, you sound like you might be a good candidate for this, and blah, blah, blah. And she said, are you willing to do like these things? And one of them was to start journaling. Another one was to go through a process that she taught, which is called the Divine Intelligence Process. And the third one was a rewire process, which was part of the Divine Intelligence Process, literally a lock yourself in a room for 3 days while you do some really deep work. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And so I had to go through the Divine Intelligence program in order to go into her life coaching program. And the reason why she does it that way is she wants to strip you of all your self-limiting beliefs. You have to be authentic. You have to really have full self-acceptance to be able to help other people. And so that's what the Divine Intelligence Process does. It's a 12-week process that you go through. And at about 8 weeks, you do this rewire, and really incredible. And you come out of there a new person. You come out of there with affirmations about not what you didn't like about yourself, but what you did like about yourself. And what was so cool about that was I found all these things that I really didn't like about myself. And they were the same things that if I reapplied the energy, turned into these strengths of mine. I saw every single one of them clear as day. And I was like, wow, this is like, this turns into this, and this turns into this. And so it was just really about reapplying my energy and my intention, how I use these things. And so that was a game changer for me. And so it's something that I work with my clients on now. I teach the divine intelligence process. I've been certified to teach that. And I also, and I bring a lot of that in to my coaching practice. But, you know, the things that I want to do, I have two goals when I work with a client. One is I want them to find self-acceptance, right? And then two, I want them to have intentional behaviors, right? Because that's the only way that change happens. So if we don't become conscious of what we're trying to do or what we want to do, then we don't do it. And so that's really the foundation of my coaching practice, is to work regardless of what people want to do. I'm working with a woman right now who is interested in getting a better job. And she's really, without going into too much detail about her, she's a person that has all the talent, right? And she has all the skills, and she hasn't manifested her strengths yet. And her problem is she doesn't have the confidence when she sits down to have an interview, because she doesn't feel like she's qualified, even though she's got, you know, 3 degrees, you know, but she still doesn't feel like she's qualified to move to like this next level. And she always chokes, you know? And so this is what we've been working through, is building that self-acceptance and helping her see, you know, like how her strengths, and then getting her to talk about her strengths. And so one of the things that I do with my clients is I have them do what I call appreciative writing. So when they journal, I make them talk about the wins. So they have to look at, okay, what did I win yesterday? Maybe I had a positive thought here, or I caught myself in a bad thought here, or I did this. But you really write about, you write in third person, you say, you know, yesterday, you know, Jeff did this and he did that, and it was so exciting because he wouldn't normally do that. And so you do it appreciative writing. And so that gets people more comfortable talking about themselves. So again, you could grow up in an environment like me, where my mother used to say, "Who do you think you are?" Right.
And that was negative.
And that was negative, but you could exactly say exactly that same word and say, absolutely, yeah. I know who I
really like what you're. I really like what you're talking about as far as the appreciation. I was somewhere along the line said, somebody write down every compliment you've ever been given in your life. You know, spend days doing it. Just write. And I had 2 or 3 pads, you know, and back to childhood. And, then they said, okay, now rest assured, 20% of that's bullshit.
Somebody wanted something.
They wanted something.
Exactly.
But that's also leaves that 80%, and there's a message in there.
Yeah.
There's a message, and look deeply at that, because people genuinely are giving you a gift.
Yeah,
exactly. There's an entire field that both of you are aware of, and it's certainly one that has come to me, called appreciative inquiry, which is, it comes out of the positive psychology movement in the sense that they say in positive psychology, you're merely studying, okay, well, yes, there are plenty of people that are studying why people go insane. Who's studying how people stay sane? What would be the value in studying that? And an appreciative inquiry is that let us study what is going right. Why is it going right? That it's worthwhile asking those questions and digging deep into the reasons why. And I see you taking your clients, and as we're doing with us, really working in that space to realize what is there.
Yeah. That's typically, we use appreciative inquiry right in the consult. So when we talk with people, you know, what we do is we give them a balance wheel, and the balance wheel has 7 different aspects of their life. And then we have them grade, you know, those aspects of their life on a 1 to 10 rating, you know. So your spirituality, where is that? Your career, where is that? Your love life, where is that? Or relationships, you know, your family. And so there's these 7, you know, different aspects that we have them grade. And then during the consultation, we start having conversations with them, and we use the appreciative inquiry process there. Tell me about a time, you know, when you were here, you know, what would make that a 10 versus a 6, right? And so those are all appreciative inquiry techniques to get people to then open up, And, you know, another technique that we use is called a positive anchor. We get people to move to a place where they had great joy and they're much more open emotionally. And then you can start having a conversation with them. Mm. So, there's a lot of good, you know, coaching techniques that are non-manipulative that are very effective in helping people find their own insights.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite quotes is from Galileo. And he said, you can't teach anybody anything. You can only help them find it within themselves. Yeah. And so that's the coaching process that I use.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you find more women, more men are seeking some coaching, and what age range, you know?
And are you seeing any delta with it? Are you seeing any changes? Are we getting an opportunity to see this happen?
Yeah, I don't think there's I don't think the needle goes one way or the other. You know, I see a lot of women stepping forward, but I also coach a lot of men. A lot of the times what happens is, especially with men, is they'll come to me thinking that they want to fix something, right? And so then we'll start talking about that. And one of the things that we do as a practice is we have what we call, you know, a big A, which is, you know, the kind of the overarching goal. And then we have the little one, and that's what we work on a week-to-week basis. And so, you know, I sit down with them, we do a client contract, and I say, okay, so your goal then is yada, yada, yada. And they're like, yep. And so the first week they come to me and I say, okay, XYZ, what do you want to coach on? And then they start talking about something and I have to ask them, I say, what does this have to do with your big goal? And they'll look at me and they're like, well, what do you mean? Well, so I told you, you told me you wanted to fix this. And I said, I did? And then they'll kind of be like, oh yeah. So they get embarrassed a little bit, you know, and then they realize that, you know, they start understanding that there are all these other little pieces that feed into that. And so I like to bring them back all the time. I'm like, okay, let's figure out, you know, let's talk about how this connects to your coaching goal. And a lot of times they will. They'll start saying, okay, well, this happened and then that happened and then so and so and blah, 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 and boom. And then we're right back there. Right. And so then we can kind of deconstruct that whole thing and work on that during that session. And then say, okay, at the end of the session, we say, you know, how do you feel this helped you move towards your goal? You know, and again, I like to use scales. You know, did we move you know, 5 points or 10 points towards the goal with this one thing? And then I give them homework, you know, and I have them work on some stuff for the next week. And so it's a process that, you know, if we can get 3 weeks of consistency, it's really, really, really good. And the guys snap in, right? The guys will come in. Women, on the other hand, they're much more in tune with what they want and what they want to try and fix. You know, so a lot of times they'll be very specific about, you know, I want to get a better job. You know, so I'm a spiritual fitness coach, and I get a lot of women that want to do transformation kind of stuff. You know, I want to lose weight. I want to lose, you know, 40 pounds. And so and then with women, my challenge is more along the line of expectations. It's more like, okay, you want to lose 40 pounds. That's totally feasible. You know, how much time do you want to give yourself to do that? And they're like, a month. And I'm like, that's not feasible. And they're like, well, why not? And then I have to ask them, I say, you know, are you willing to do what you need in order to get what you want? And that almost stops them dead in their tracks because they're kind of like, well, sure. And I'm like, okay, so you're going to eat 500 calories a day for the next 30 days and drink celery juice and, you know, all these, and you're wanting to work out twice a day. And they're like, man, all of a sudden their face is like, no. And it's like, okay, let's change the expectations. But, you know, and then I get into the conversation about, why do you want to lose 40 pounds? Well, you know, there's this dress I used to wear and blah, blah, blah. And they're, like I said, they're so specific about stuff and I love it because they're honest, you know? And, but there's something there, you know, there's always this thing in the background. That's driving them to what they want to do, you know? So I like looking at motivations. I'm fascinated with what motivates people and what's driving their motivation and how real they are. What I like to do is I like to try to find people that have these distorted extrinsic motivations, right? These are motivations that are coming from the outside world, telling them what they should be, and finding the same value with an intrinsic motivation and getting them on that line, right? So that they're empowered. And so if I can shift that for them and get them moving along that way, now they've got purpose. They know what that why is. There's autonomy there. You know, now it's theirs. It's not somebody else's. And what I explain to them is, like, if you have an extrinsic motivation, what happens if that disappears? You have no control over that. What you do have control over is you, you know? And so you need to find your source from in here. And so with a lot of the fitness stuff, that's where I go with these people. I try and get them to find that intrinsic motivation, and we get lined up on that. And it's the same conversation. So we're going to the gym, and I'm like, what's your goal? Right. And now saying, okay. And then I put together a plan that helps them get to their goal. So I do it in different ways.
Wow. Where were you when I was 18?
Jeff, do you see anything that is in today with the polarization that you're helping, that you can help us to serve when we get into the situations where we are hearing from dear loved ones or people that we care about, issues that are completely at odds with what our values seem to be.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, curiosity. And again, even if you're having a conversation with those, maybe it's somebody from another generation, you know, an older generation. You have to ask questions about, you know, why do you think that way? You know, why do you believe that way? Why, by the way, why is not a good question.
Right.
It puts people on a defensive, mm-hmm. but just to illustrate my point, you need to say, you know, Grandpa, you said, you know, the N word, and I don't understand, you know, tell me about when you were a kid and how did you learn that and why was it okay? Right. And throw it back to them, because I think, you know, we grew up like we were talking about earlier with me, we do things and we know that it's not right, you know, and it creates a lot of stress and anxiety, you know, on us, but we still continue to do it because we think it's the right thing. And we think that it's going to protect our persona, right? It's our shield and our sword. Until it gets to the point where, you know, we have to hit the relief valve. So regardless of who you're having the conversation with, you have to believe that there's a shred of decency and dignity within them. And they know that some of these things are wrong. It's just a matter of, you know, they've done it for so long, they're going to continue to do it. They're not willing to change.
One of the things I know I'm interrupting you here, but I want to toss it back to what you were saying earlier. As long as I have someone outside of myself to blame, I never have to take that first step of responsibility about looking inside myself. So I can otherize people, or I can otherize issues, or I can otherize, then I can always say, well, if that were only fixed, it would be the same thing as I would saying, wow, if I only had $1 million, I would be happy. Well, we have done so many studies of lottery winners that while they get a sugar high from the winning of the lottery, they within a year have returned back to the state of emotional state where they had before they won the lottery.
Absolutely.
So it's not that. It's something that is outside of myself that I'm saying that if only that were different, then I would be okay. And it means I never have to look at inside myself.
Yeah. So going back to the divine intelligence process, we talk about two different states of being. One is our conditioned state and one is our authentic state. And so when you're dealing with people that are creating conditions for everything, right? So that's what they're doing when they're otherizing. They're creating a condition, right? That's allowing something else. You know, you try and remove that condition. You try and have a conversation with them where you say, imagine that condition is now gone. You can't rely on that condition any longer. It's like, saying to someone, I'll quit smoking when this pack of cigarettes is gone.
Right? When those Oreos are done, I'm right. through.
Right.
Bluebell ice cream.
You know, I'll take a dance class when I lose 10 pounds. So what you've done is you've created a condition that's in between you and the goal, right? I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, right now I've created this condition. And so, again, this is what I do with coaching is I try and find. So really what you want to do is you want to take the dance class, right? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, instead of saying, why do you need to lose 10 pounds? I say, you know, what's the dance class going to do for you? And they'll say, oh, it's this and that. And then, you know, and somewhere along the line, you find out that it brings them joy, right? And you say, so why would you want to sacrifice your joy because, you know, you're 10 pounds overweight, right? Now you've created this condition, right? And you're denying yourself joy. And so now what I try and do is I push them down that path that, hey, maybe the dance class is the place where you lose 10 pounds. You know, maybe you're out there doing a dance class where you're also trying to take care of this conditional thing that you want to get rid of. And so there's a lot of different ways that you can tackle that. It's a little bit harder when you get somebody that's not open and willing to have a conversation or to think openly like that. You've got to be a little bit smarter in how you have the conversation with these people. And sometimes, you know, you'd be surprised, though, when you ask somebody a really tough question, you know, and they think about it and they answer you, you can see them change, you know, right as they're answering you, because they've known that tension of opposites has always been there and they've always gone this way. But now they've got the opportunity to say, this is how I really feel, but I've never been able to act that way because, right?
This is the opportunity. What I love about being around you, Jeff, is that you continue to remind me that I am the one that is giving away my power.
Yeah.
It was never true. It was never true. It would always, the power of decision, the power of choice was always in here. And that my opportunity is to choose again.
Yeah.
And I love the idea. You had said this earlier. You were talking about sin. And one of my teachers, one of my favorite teachers in religious science, talks about sin being an archery term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it's merely missing the mark. And my job is to take another arrow, realign, and breathe, and slowly let go and get closer to the mark. And using that as the term brings me an opportunity to do it less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clay, you have seen yourself grow in this self-acceptance, this process that you and I have been going through since, not just since we've met, but with all the people that you're connecting with. This self-acceptance has been such an astonishing part of your journey. We've talked about it often.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I spent years, you know, clinically depressed because I wouldn't accept myself. I was in an environment that I felt less than. And I just fed on that, and it was incredibly unhealthy. And along with that, I had a incredible distrust of other men. So the ability to connect with somebody and say, oh, well, it's not quite that way, to learn from another person, I isolated myself because of that.
Even though you had the trappings of all uh-huh. the trappings of success,
oh, yeah.
all the trappings of what the world would say was the top, that was...
Well, I mean, after my heart attack and bypass surgery, I went to the top of the Empire State Building for the first time. My office was down there on 32nd and Park, right? And I looked at that little window down there and I said, you know, metaphorically, I've made it to the top. It's almost killed me. Who am I? Why am I here? And where am I going? And that was an important moment because I knew life was going to change. And long story short, I eventually started the men's circle because I needed to figure out how to get out of this less than and begin to trust other men.
Yes.
And so there's other guys got to feel this way too. So let's get together and figure this out. And that's where our men's circle started.
What say the Jeff?
Oh, first of all, I want to commend Clay for the work that he's done. I mean, I've had the fortune of experiencing it for the last several years and, you know, watching him kind of coming out of his shell. Mm-hmm. Clay, I remember like one of the first things that I saw you do artistically was your mandala. Uh-huh. And you had so much detail and thought and deep reverence, you know, that you built into this, not just created, but you built, it was an educational tool. And I just remember I was slack jaw the first time I saw that thing. And I had to look at everything and I had to read everything and I had to see it. And I was just like mesmerized. And I just remembered you were just so, maybe ho-hum or humble about it. And I was like, man, I just like, you know, and then I saw you start doing things with that, right? You started building on that. It was one of your first tools that you really kind of took out there. And then you wrote your book. And I started seeing you step out of the shadow a little bit and into yourself. And it's been a beautiful thing.
Hasn't it just, I agree. In the time that I've known you, Clay, this has been and it's wonderful because like all great teachers, you do that by let me show you rather than telling you and telling you how to do it. Let me walk first. Even when I stumble, even when I stagger a bit, but I'm going to go out there. I'm going to walk out there first. I'm going to take point and do this. And that's what I've seen you do, Clay, why I love you. And I feel so, so impassioned to be with you on this journey because of that. Because like any great teacher, you are a great learner. I've never known a great teacher that is not that.
Well, thank you. I'm blessed with those words. And I wouldn't be where I am today if it were not for the men walking Amen. Alongside me. That's it. That was the difference, was to be able to recognize that we're all wounded. Let's honor that with one another and let's figure this out. And that's work that men need to do with men. That's work I needed to do with other men.
And me.
Yeah.
And so that's the basic of it, is that connection has enabled me to grow this far along the journey.
Yes. And I love that. I'm trying to attach the words anytime that I think I ever make a statement. Well, this has not happened, or I haven't done. I always try to put at the end of it, so far.
Right.
because the stories that I tell myself, the self-limiting stories, they're the ones that are really attenuating my life more than anything that the world, and of course, yes, white male privilege, upper middle class upbringing. And I've literally been on third base rounding home from the first time I've ever, ever had a consciousness, but still, even with that, there's so many stories that I've told myself because I want to be part of this healing in the world, this opportunity. This is a chance. Look at us, the three of us, getting a chance to talk and share and being able to connect in this way is profound. And I do not want to minimize it.
Yeah. Well, I think, to Clay's point, men, sharing with men is key. And I say it all the time that vulnerability, you know, is the golden ticket to getting help. Because especially you do it in a trusting, non-judgmental, non-fixing kind of environment where you get into that environment and you see the trust that's there, you know, and then you hear other guys' stories that are the same stories as yours. And I don't want to make light of this because some of these stories are full of shame and embarrassment and things that have happened, and you've had that same experience, right? And so immediately, right, you connect with that person. You can empathize with them now because you really feel what they're feeling because you've been there in that same situation. And we don't allow ourselves to do that as men. That is persona non grata in our society. And even to today, we're getting better, and I'm not sure that we're at the horizon there, but it'll be nice when we get over the horizon and it becomes common and guys can have places everywhere to do this.
I agree.
You know, yeah. I tell you, the more I am out there and the more we're connecting around the world, the story is the same.
Yeah.
You know, every man, I'm going to say, make it an absolute, has got this void inside of them that they're trying to figure out. And so much of that can be, oh, you've got that too. Oh, I'm not alone. Let's figure this out. And this notion of, you know, you guys got to go into your heart is not about leaving your head behind.
Yeah.
It's about integrating the two.
Absolutely.
It took me forever to figure that one out.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a coherence, you know, that we have to have with our intellect and our intuition, you know, and when we get that Kundalini kind of energy, you know, when we get that coherence, it's incredible. I mean, you know, you're basically unstoppable.
Exactly.
When you can marry those two things, especially if you're, you know, in a place of self-acceptance, because I think the challenge that most of us have in growing up and we carry with us for such a long time is that what happened to us defines who we are, right? We allow it to define us. And I remember reading a Carl Jung quote that says, you know, it's not what happened to you, it's what you choose to become. And that one quote for me was a life changer. You know, I said, yeah, I can decide. I can make different choices. I can choose to show up in the world as a different person, you know? And so, and say all these things that happened to me that were keeping me here and keep me in that persona, those things don't define me, you know? And I am not going to allow them to define me. So, yeah.
This is wonderful. Is there anything in the last minute or so, Jeff, that we haven't talked about that's on your heart today?
I don't think so. When I was thinking about this call itself, I was thinking about all these different things that have been going on, the turbulence that's out there. And, you know, equality and equanimity are so important. My prayer as we go forward is that, you know, we as a society, you know, are able to, you know, reconcile the things that we need to reconcile, and we can move to discourse and we can have conversations and not be so polarized.
Amen.
What a beautiful way to leave this at the end of September of 2020 with all this ahead of us. Thank you so much, Jeff, for joining us on the podcast. Clay, thank you so much. And we will see all of you next time on In Search of the New Compassionate Male.